Chapter 11. That night. School days. Dad leaves. The well of the worlds. The other. The old woman. A nasty surprise. 1.
Are you all right, Charlie?
I looked up from my book. I'd been deep into it. I would have said nothing could take my mind off the tape I'd listened to in Mr. Bowditch's kitchen, the one that was now hidden on the top shelf of my closet, under a stack of old T-shirts. But this one had. This one, which I'd taken from Mr. Bowditch's bedroom, had conjured its own world. Radar was sleeping beside me, occasionally giving out with little snores. Huh?
I asked if you're all right. You hardly touched your dinner, and you've seemed off all evening.
Thinking about Mr. Bowditch? Well, yeah. It was the truth, although not exactly the way Dad thought.
You miss him?
I do. A lot. I reached down and stroked Radar's neck. My dog now. My dog, my responsibility.
That's okay. The way it should be. Are you going to be okay next week?
Sure, why? He gave the sort of patient sigh which I think maybe only dads can give.
The retreat. I told you about it. You had your mind on other things, I guess. I leave Tuesday morning for 4 wonderful days in the North Woods. It's an overland gig, but Lindy wangled me an invitation to come along. Plenty of seminars on liability, which will be merely okay. And some on vetting fraudulent claims, which is a big deal, especially for a firm just getting on its feet.
Like yours.
Like mine. Also, bonding exercises.
He rolled his eyes. Will there be drinking?
There will, a lot, but not by me. Are you going to be okay on your own?
Sure.
Assuming I didn't get lost in what Mr. Bowditch claimed was a very dangerous city ruled over by a sleeping god. Assuming I went at all.
I'll be fine. If anything comes up, I'll call you.
You're smiling. Something funny?
Just that I'm not 10 anymore, Dad.
Actually, what made me smile was wondering if there was cell service in the well of the worlds. I was guessing Verizon hadn't opened that territory yet.
Sure there's nothing I can help you with?
Tell him, I thought. Nope. All good.
What's a bonding exercise?
I'll show you. Get up.
He got up himself.
Now stand behind me.
I put my book on the chair and stood behind him.
We're supposed to trust the team, Dad said. Not that I actually have one, being a one-man show, but I can be a good sport. We climb trees with a...
Trees? You climb trees?
On many overland retreats, sometimes not completely sober. With a spotter. We'll all do it, except for Willie Deegan, who has a pacemaker.
Jesus, Dad.
And we do this.
He fell backward with no warning, his hands loosely clasped at his waist. I wasn't playing sports anymore, but there was nothing wrong with my reflexes. I caught him easily, and looking at him upside down, I saw his eyes were closed and he was smiling. I loved him for that smile. I gave him a heave and he went back on his feet. Radar was looking at us. She made a
"roof"
sound and put her head back down.
I'll have to trust whoever's behind me. It'll probably be Norm Richards. But I trust you more, Charlie. We're bonded.
That's great, Dad, but don't fall out of any trees. Taking care of one guy who took a fall is my limit. Now, can I read my book?
Go for it.
He picked it up off the chair and looked at the cover.
One of Mr. Bowditch's?
Yes.
I read it when I was your age, maybe even younger. Crazy Carnival comes to a little town, right here in Illinois, as I remember.
Cougar and Dark's Pandemonium Shadow Show.
All I remember is that there was a blind fortune teller. She was creepy.
Yeah, the Dust Witch is mondo creepy, all right.
You read. I'll watch television and rot my brain. Just don't give yourself any nightmares.
If I sleep at all, I thought. too.
Although Radar could probably make it up the stairs with the new medicine on board, I went into the little guest room and she padded after me, already perfectly at home in our place. I undressed to my shorts, propped the extra pillow under my head, and kept reading. On the tape, Mr. Bowditch said there was a huge sundial in a plaza behind a palace, and it turned, like the carousel in the Bradbury novel, and it was the secret of his longevity. The sundial had allowed him to come back to Century's Rest young enough to impersonate his own son. In Something Wicked, the carousel could make you older when it went forward, but younger when it was in reverse. And Mr. Bowditch had said something else, or started to. I'm sure he... Never mind. Had he started to say that Ray Bradbury had gotten his idea for the carousel from the sundial in that other world? The idea of gaining or losing years on a merry-go-round was crazy, but the idea that a respected American author had visited that other place was even crazier, wasn't it? Bradbury had spent his early childhood in Waukegan, which was less than 70 miles from Century's Rest. A brief visit to Bradbury's Wikipedia entry convinced me that that was just a coincidence, unless he had visited the other world as a little kid, if there was another world. Anyway, by the time he was my age, he was living in Los Angeles. I'm sure he... Never mind. I marked my place in the book and put it on the floor. I was pretty sure Will and Jim would survive their adventures, but I guessed they would never be so innocent again. Kids shouldn't have to face terrible things. I knew that from experience. I got up and pulled on my pants. Come on, Raids. You need to go out and water the grass. She came willingly enough, not limping at all. She'd be lame again in the morning, but after a little exercise, her locomotion would smooth out. At least it had so far. That wouldn't last much longer if the vet's assistant had been right. She'd said she'd be surprised if Radar made it to Halloween, and that was only 5 weeks away. A little less, actually. Raid sniffed around on the lawn. I looked up at the stars, picking out Orion's belt and the Big Dipper, that old standby. According to Mr. Bowditch, there were two moons in that other world, and constellations the astronomers of Earth had never seen. Not possible. None of it. Yet the well was there. And the steps. And that horrible fucking bug. I had seen those things. Radar lowered her hindquarters in that delicate way of hers, then came to me looking for a treat. I gave her half a bones and led her back inside. I'd read late and my dad had gone to bed. It was time for me to do the same. Mr. Bowditch's dog, my dog, plopped down with a sigh and a fart, no more than a tweet, really. I turned off the light and stared up into the dark. Tell Dad everything. Take him out to the shed. The bug Mr. Bowditch shot will still be there, some of it, anyway. And even if it was gone, the well will be there. This is heavy, so share the load.
Would my father keep the secret? Much as I loved him, I didn't trust that he would or could. There are 1,000 slogans and mottos in AA, and one of them is, "You're only as sick as your secrets." Might he confide to Lindy, or a trusted friend at work? His brother, my Uncle Bob? Then I remembered something from school, way back in 6th or 7th grade, American history, Miss Greenfield. It was a quote from Benjamin Franklin. 3 may keep a secret if 2 of them are dead. Can you imagine what would happen if people found out there is another world down there? That had been Mr. Bowditch's question, and I thought I knew the answer. It would be taken over. Co-opted, my hippy-dippy history teacher would have said. The house at 1 Sycamore Street would become a top-secret government installation. For all I knew, the whole neighborhood would be cleared. And yes, then the exploitation would begin. And if Mr. Bowditch was right, the consequences could be terrible. I finally went to sleep, but dreamed I was awake and something was moving under the bed. I knew, in the way of dreams, what it was. A giant roach. One that bit. I awoke in a small hour of the morning, convinced it was true. But Radar would have barked, and she was deeply asleep, woofling her way through some unknowable dream of her own. 3. On Sunday, I went up to Mr. Bowditch's house to do what I'd meant to do the day before, start cleaning the place up. There were some things I couldn't do, of course. The torn cushions and slashed wallpaper would have to wait. There was plenty of other stuff, but I had to take care of it in 2 separate shifts because the first time I brought Radar, and that was a mistake. She went from room to room downstairs, looking for Mr. Bowditch. She didn't seem to be upset by the vandalism, but barked furiously at the couch, only pausing to look at me every now and then, as if to ask if I was stupid. Couldn't I see what was wrong? Her master's bed had disappeared. I got her to follow me into the kitchen and told her to down, but she wouldn't, only kept looking toward the living room. I offered her a chicken chip, her favorite snack, but she dropped it on the linoleum. I decided I'd have to take her back home and leave her with Dad, but when she saw the leash, she ran, very limberly, through the living room and up the stairs. I found her in Mr. Bowditch's bedroom, curled up in front of the closet, on a makeshift bed of clothes that had been torn off their hangers. She seemed okay there, so I went back downstairs and made things as much better as I could. Around 11 o'clock, I heard the click of her nails on the stairs. Seeing her hurt my heart. She wasn't limping, but she moved slowly, with her head down and her tail drooping. She looked at me with an expression as clear as words. "Where is he?" "Come on, girl," I said. "Let's get you out of here." That time she didn't protest the leash. 4. In the afternoon, I did what I could with the upstairs. The little man in the white Sox cap and corduroy pants, assuming it was him, which I did, hadn't done any damage on the third floor, at least as I could see. I thought he'd concentrated his attention on the second floor, and on the safe once he found it. He'd have been keeping an eye on the time, too, knowing that funeral services only last so long. I gathered up my clothes and put them in a little pile at the head of the stairs, meaning to take them home. Then I went to work on Mr. Bowditch's bedroom, righting the bed, which had been turned over, rehanging his clothes, tucking in pockets as I went, and picking up stuffing from the pillows. I was angry at Mr. Righto, ha-ha, for what seemed almost like a desecration of the dead, but I couldn't help thinking of some of the sorry crap I'd pulled with Birdie Bird. Dog shit on windshields, firecrackers in mailboxes, full garbage cans overturned, Jesus Jerks Off spray-painted on the signboard of Grace Methodist Church. We'd never been caught, and yet I had. Looking at the mess Mr. Ha-Ha had left behind and hating it, I realized I had caught myself. Back then, I'd been as bad as the little man with the funny way of walking and talking. Worse, in some ways. The little man at least had a motive. He'd been looking for gold. The Birdman and I had just been a couple of kids fucking off and fucking up. Except, of course, the Birdman and I had never killed anyone. If I was right, Mr. Ha-Ha had. One of the bedroom bookcases had been overturned. I set it upright and started reshelving the books. At the bottom of the pile was that scholarly-looking tome I'd seen on his nightstand, along with the Bradbury novel I was currently reading. I picked it up and looked at the cover. A funnel filling with stars. The Origins of Fantasy and Its Place in the World Matrix. What a mouthful. And Jungian Perspectives to boot. I looked in the index to see if there was anything about the story of Jack and the Beanstalk. Turned out there was. I tried to read it, then just scanned it. It was everything I hated about what I thought of as hoity-toity academic writing, full of $5 words and tortured syntax. Maybe that's intellectual laziness on my part, but maybe not. So far as I could make out, the author of that particular chapter was saying there were actually two Beanstalk stories, the bloodthirsty original and the sanitized version kids got in mom-approved Little Golden books and the feature-length cartoon. The bloodthirsty original bifurcated, there's one of your $5 words, into two mythic streams, one dark and one light. The dark one had to do with the joys of plunder and murder, as in Jack chopping down the beanstalk and the giant getting smushed. The light one had to do with what the writer called the epistemology of Wittgensteinian religious belief. And if you know what that one means, even with its headlights on, you're a better man than I am. I put the book on the shelf, left the room, then went back again to look at the cover. The inside was full of trudging prose, compound complex sentences that allowed the eye no rest, but the cover was a little lyric. As perfect, in its way, as that William Carlos Williams poem about the red wheelbarrow. A funnel filling with stars. 5. On Monday, I went to see my old pal Mrs. Silvius in the office and asked her if I could take my once-a-semester community service day on Tuesday. She leaned over the desk toward me and spoke in a low, confidential voice.
"Do I smell a boy who wants to play hooky?" I only ask because students are asked to give at least 1 week's notice before they take their in-service day. Not a requirement, Charlie, but a strong suggestion.
"No, this is the real deal," I said, making earnest eye contact. It was a useful technique when telling lies that I had learned from Bertie Bird. "I'm going around to downtown merchants and pitching them on Adopta."
"Adopta?"
Mrs. Silvius looked interested in spite of herself. "Well, it's actually Adopta Highway. I got into that with Key Club, but I want to go farther. Get store owners interested in Adopta Park. We've actually got 6 of them, you know. And Adopt an Underpass? So many of them are messes, it's really a shame. Maybe even adopt a vacant lot if I can convince..."
"I get the drift."
She grabbed a form and scribbled on it.
"Take this around to your teachers, get a sign-off from all of them, and bring it back to me."
And as I left,
"Charlie, I still smell hooky. I smell it all over you."
I wasn't exactly lying about my community service project, but I was shading the truth about needing a day off from school to do it. During period 5, I went to the library, got a JC's booklet listing all the downtown merchants, and sent out an e-blast, just changing the salutations and the names of the various Adopta projects I'd thought up. It took half an hour, which left me with 20 minutes before the chime announcing the change of classes. I went back to the desk and asked Ms. Norman if she had Grimm's Fairy Tales. The actual book wasn't in the library, so she handed me a Kindle with Property of Hillview High Dymo tape to the back and gave me the one-use-only code to download the book. I didn't read any of the fairy tales, only ran down the contents and skimmed the introduction. I was interested, but not entirely surprised, to find that most of the ones I knew from childhood had darker versions. The original of Goldilocks and the Three Bears was an oral tale that had been around since the 1500s, and there was no little girl named Goldilocks in it. The main character was a vile old woman who invaded the bears' home, basically broke all their shit, then jumped out a window and ran away into the woods, cackling. Rumpelstiltskin was even worse. In the version I vaguely remembered, old Rumpel flew away in a huff when the girl tasked with spinning straw into gold guessed his name. In the 1857 version of Grimm's, he drove 1 foot into the ground, grasped the other, and tore himself apart. I thought that was a horror story worthy of the Saw franchise. Period 6 was a single semester course called America Today. I had no idea what Mr. Masensic was saying. I was thinking about make-believe, how the carousel in Something Wicked was like the sundial in the Land of Other, for instance. "The secret of my longevity," Mr. Bowditch had said. Jack had stolen gold from the giant. Mr. Bowditch had also stolen gold from who or what? A giant? Some Pulp Fiction demon named Gog Magog? Once my mind started down this path, I saw similarities everywhere. My mother had died on a bridge spanning the Little Rumpel River. And what about the little man with the funny voice? Wasn't that how the story described Rumpelstiltskin? And then there was me. How many stories of make-believe featured a young hero, like Jack, on a quest in a fantastic land? Or take The Wizard of Oz, where a tornado lifted a little girl out of Kansas and into a world of witches and munchkins. I wasn't Dorothy, and Radar wasn't Toto, but... Charles? Have you fallen asleep back there? Or perhaps my mellifluous voice has hypnotized you? Entranced you? Laughter from the class, most of whom wouldn't have known mellifluous from a piss hole in the snow. No, I'm right here. Then perhaps you'd give us your considered opinion concerning the blue-on-black shootings of Philando Castile and Alton Sterling? Bad shit, I said. I was still mostly in my own head, and it just popped out of my mouth. Mr. Misensic favored me with his trademark thin smile, then said, Bad shit indeed. Please feel free to re-enter your trance state, Mr. Reed. He continued his lecture. I tried to pay attention, but then I thought of something Mrs. Silvius had said. Not, fee, fi, fo, fum, I smell the blood of an Englishman, but I still smell hooky. I smell it all over you. Surely a coincidence. My father said if you bought a blue car, you saw blue cars everywhere. But after what I'd seen in the shed, I couldn't help wondering. And something else. In a fantasy story, the author would invent some way that the young hero or heroine could explore that world I was starting to think of as the other. The author might, for instance, invent a retreat his parent or parents had to attend for several days, thus clearing the way for the young hero to visit the other world without provoking a bunch of questions he couldn't answer. Coincidence, I thought, as the class-ending chime went and kids bolted for the door. Blue car syndrome. Except the giant roach was no blue car, and neither were those stone steps winding down into the dark. I got Mr. Misensic to sign my community service slip, and he gave me his thin smile. Bad shit, eh? Sorry. Actually, you weren't wrong. I made my escape and headed for my locker.
Charlie?
It was Arnetta Freeman, looking relatively gorgeous in her skinny jeans and shell top. With blue eyes and blonde hair down to her shoulders, Arnetta proved that white America ain't all bad. The year before, when I'd been more sporty and at least a little bit famous for my turkey bowl heroics, Arnetta and I had spent several study sessions in her basement family room. Some studying had been done, but a lot more making out.
Hey, Arnie, what's up? Do you want to come over tonight? We could study for the Hamlet test.
Those blue eyes looking deep into my brown ones.
I'd love to, but my dad's leaving for most of the rest of the week tomorrow. Some kind of business thing. I better stick around.
Oh, poo, that's a shame. She hugged two books tenderly to her breasts.
I could Wednesday night. If you're not busy, that is.
She brightened.
That'd be fantastic.
She took my hand and placed it on her waist.
I'll quiz you on Polonius, and maybe you can check out my Fortinbras.
She gave me a peck on the cheek, then walked away, backside switching in a way that was, well, bewitching. For the first time since the library, I wasn't thinking about real-world parallels to make-believe ones. My mind was on nothing but Arnetta Freeman. 6. My dad left bright and early on Tuesday morning, carrying his traveling bag and wearing his I'm going to the woods clothes. Corduroy pants, flannel shirt, bear's hat. He carried a poncho slung over one shoulder.
Rain in the forecast, he said. That'll put the kibosh on any tree climbing, for which I'm not sorry.
Club soda at cocktail hour, right?
He grinned.
Maybe with a slice of lime.
Not to worry, kiddo.
Lindy will be there, and I'll stick with him. Take care of your dog, she's limping again.
I know.
He gave me a quick one-armed squeeze and a kiss on the jaw. As he backed down the driveway, I held up my hand in a stop gesture and ran to the driver's side window. He lowered it.
Did I forget something?
No, I did. I leaned in, hugged him around the neck, and kissed his cheek. He gave me a puzzled smile.
What was that for?
I just love you, that's all.
Same here, Charlie.
He patted my cheek, backed into the street, and took off toward the goddamn bridge. I watched him go until he was out of sight. I guess that down deep, I knew something. 7. I took radar out back. Our yard wasn't much compared to Mr. Bowditch's acre plus, but it was big enough to give Raid some room to limber up. Which she eventually did, but I knew her time was getting short. If there was something I could do for her, it would have to be soon. We went back in, and I gave her a few spoonfuls of the leftover meatloaf from last night, hiding an extra pill in it. She wolfed it down, then curled up on the living room rug, a place that she'd already staked out as her own. I rubbed her behind her ears, which always made her close her eyes and grin. I have to check something out, I said. Be a good girl. I'll be back as soon as I can, okay? Try not to shit in the house, but if you have to, do it someplace where it'll be easy to clean up. She flapped her tail on the rug a couple of times. That was good enough for me. I rode my bike up to number one, keeping my eye out for a funny little man with a funny way of walking and talking. I saw no one, not even Mrs. Richland. I let myself in, went upstairs, opened the safe, and buckled the gun belt around my waist. I didn't feel like a gunslinger, in spite of the fancy conchos and the tie-downs. I felt like a scared kid. If I slipped on those spiral stairs and fell, how long would it be before someone found me? Maybe never. And if they did, what else would they find? On the tape, Mr. Bowditch had said what he was leaving me wasn't a gift, but a burden. I didn't fully understand that then, but as I took the flashlight from the kitchen cupboard and shoved the long barrel into the back pocket of my jeans, I sure did. I went out to the shed, hoping that I'd get to the bottom of those steps and find not a corridor leading to some other world, but only a pile of blocks and a scummy pool of groundwater. And no big cockroaches. I don't care if they're harmless or not. No roaches. I went into the shed, shone the light around, and saw that the roach Mr. Bowditch had shot was subsiding into a dark gray puddle of goo. As I put the flashlight beam on it, one of the plates on what remained of its back slid off, making me jump. I turned on the battery lights, went to the boards and blocks covering the well, and shone my light through one of the 6-inch cracks. I saw nothing but the steps, winding down into darkness. Nothing moved. There were no scuttering sounds. This did not soothe me. I thought of a line from a dozen cheap horror movies, maybe 100. I don't like it. It's too quiet. Be sensible. Quiet is good, I told myself. But looking into that stone pit, the idea didn't have much force. I understood that if I hesitated for long, I'd back out, making it twice as hard to get even this far again. So, I stuck the flashlight in my back pocket once more and lifted away the cement blocks. I slid the boards aside. Then I sat down on the lip of the well, my feet on the third step. I waited for my heart to slow down, a little, then stood on that step, telling myself there was plenty of room for my feet. This wasn't precisely true. I armed sweat from my forehead and told myself everything was going to be all right. This I didn't precisely believe. But I started down. 8. 185 stone steps of varying heights, Mr. Bowditch said, and I counted them as I went down. I moved very slowly with my back planted against the curving stone wall, facing the drop. The stones were rough and damp. I kept the flashlight trained on my feet, varying heights. I didn't want to stumble. A stumble might be the end of me. On number 90, not quite halfway, I heard rustling beneath me. I debated shining my light toward the sound and almost decided not to. If I startled a colony of giant bats and they flew up all around me, I probably would fall. That was good logic, but fear was stronger. I leaned out a bit from the wall, shone my light along the descending curve of the steps, and saw something black crouching 2 dozen steps below. When my light hit it, I had just enough time to see it was one of the jumbo roaches before it fled, scuttering into the black. I took a few deep breaths, told myself I was all right, didn't believe it, and went on. It took 9 or 10 minutes to reach the bottom because I was moving very slowly. It seemed even longer. Every now and then I looked up, and it wasn't particularly comforting to see the circle illuminated by the battery lights growing smaller and smaller. I was deep in the earth and going deeper. I reached the bottom at the 185th step. The floor was packed earth, just as Mr. Bowditch had said, and there were a few blocks that had fallen from the wall, probably from the very top, where the frost and thaw would have first loosened them and then squeezed them out. Mr. Bowditch had grabbed a crack in one of the spaces from which a block had fallen, and it had saved his life. The pile of fallen blocks was streaked with black stuff that I guessed was roach shit. The corridor was there. I stepped over the blocks and into it. Mr. Bowditch had been right. It was so tall I didn't even think about ducking my head. Now I could hear more rustling up ahead, and guessed they were the roosting bats Mr. Bowditch had warned me about. I don't like the idea of bats. They carry germs, sometimes rabies, but they don't give me the horrors as they did Mr. Bowditch. Going toward the sound of them, I was more curious than anything. Those short curving steps, of varying heights, ringing the drop had given me the phantods, but now I was on solid ground, and that was a big improvement. Of course, there were thousands of tons of rock and soil above me, but this corridor had been down here for a long time, and I didn't think it would pick this moment to collapse and bury me. Nor did I have to fear being buried alive. If the roof fell in, so to speak, I would be killed instantly. Cheerful, I thought. Cheerful I was not, but my fear was being replaced, overshadowed, at least, by excitement. If Mr. Bowditch had been telling the truth, another world was waiting not far up ahead. Having come this far, I wanted to see it. Gold was the very least of it. The dirt floor changed to stone. To cobblestones, in fact, like in old movies on TCM about London in the 19th century. Now the rustling was right over my head, and I snapped off the light. Pitch darkness made me fearful all over again, but I did not want to find myself in a cloud of bats. For all I knew, they might be vampire bats. Unlikely in Illinois. Except I wasn't really in Illinois anymore, was I? I went on a mile at least, Mr. Bowditch had said. So I counted steps until I lost count. At least there was no fear of my flashlight failing if I needed it again. The batteries in the long barrel were fresh. I kept waiting to see daylight, always listening to the soft fluttering overhead. Were the bats really as big as turkey buzzards? I didn't want to know. At last, I saw light, a bright spark, just as Mr. Bowditch had said. I walked on, and the spark turned into a circlet, bright enough to leave an afterimage on my eyes every time I blinked them shut. I had forgotten all about the lightheadedness Mr. Bowditch had spoken of, but when it hit me, I knew exactly what he'd been talking about. Once when I was 10 or so, Birdie Bird and I had hyperventilated our stupid selves and then hugged each other good and tight to see if we would pass out, as some friend of Birdie's had claimed. Neither of us did, but I went all swimmy and fell on my ass in what felt like slow motion. This was like that. I kept walking, but I felt like a helium balloon bobbing along above my own body, and if the string snapped, I would just float away. Then it passed, as Mr. Bowditch had said it did for him. He said there was a border, and that had been it. I had left Century's Rest behind, and Illinois, and America. I was in the other. I reached the opening and saw the ceiling overhead was now earth, with fine tendrils of root dangling down. I ducked under some overhanging vines and stepped out onto a sloping hillside. The sky was gray, but the field was bright red. Poppies spread in a gorgeous blanket, stretching left and right as far as I could see. A path led through the flowers toward a road. On the far side of the road, more poppies ran maybe a mile to thick woods, making me think of the forests that had once grown in my suburban town. The path was faint, but the road wasn't. It was dirt, but wide, not a track, but a thoroughfare. Where the path joined the road, there was a tidy little cottage, with smoke rising from the stone chimney. There were clotheslines with things strung on them that weren't clothes. I couldn't make out what they were. I looked to the far horizon and saw the skyline of a great city. Daylight reflected hazily from its highest towers, as if they were made of glass. Green glass. I had read The Wizard of Oz and seen the movie, and I knew an emerald city when I saw one. 9. The path to the road and the cottage was about half a mile long. I stopped twice, once to look back at the hole in the hillside. It looked like the mouth of a small cave, with those vines dangling over the entrance, and once to look at my cell phone. I was expecting a no-service message, but I didn't even get that. My iPhone wouldn't come on at all. It was just a rectangle of black glass that, over here, would be useful as a paperweight, but not for anything else. I don't remember feeling dazed or amazed, not even by the sight of those glassy spires. I didn't doubt the evidence of my senses. I could see the gray sky above, a low ceiling that suggested rain not far off. I could hear the whicker of growing things against my pants as I walked the narrow path. As I descended the hill, most of the buildings of the city sank from sight. I could only see the highest three spires. I tried to guess how far away it was and couldn't. 30 miles? 40? Best of all was the smell of poppies, like cocoa and vanilla and cherries. Except for putting my face into my mom's hair to inhale her scent when I was small, it was the most delicious aroma that had ever graced my olfactories, hands down. I hoped the rain would hold off, but not because I didn't want to get wet. I knew rain would increase that smell, and the beauty of it might kill me. I'm exaggerating, but not as much as you might think. I saw no rabbits, great or small, but I could hear them, hopping around in the grass and flowers, and once, for a few seconds, I saw tall ears. There was also the chirring sound of crickets, and I wondered if they were big like the roaches and bats. As I neared the back of the cottage, wooden sides, thatched roof, I stopped, bemused by what I could now make out. Hanging from the crisscrossing lines behind the cottage and on either side of it were shoes. Wooden ones, canvas ones, sandals, slippers. One line bowed under the weight of a suede boot with silver buckles. Was it a 7-league boot, like in the old fairy tales? It certainly looked like one to me. I came closer and reached out to touch it. It was as soft as butter and as smooth as satin. Built for the road, I thought. Built for Puss in Boots. Where's the other? As if summoned by the thought, the cottage's back door opened and a woman came out with the other boot in her hand, the buckles gleaming in the mellow light of that white sky day. I knew she was a woman because she was wearing a pink dress and red shoes, also because generous breasts plumped out the bodice of her dress. But her skin was slate gray, and her face was cruelly deformed. It was as if her features had been drawn in charcoal and some bad-tempered deity had rubbed its hand across them, smearing and blurring them almost out of existence. Her eyes were slits, as were her nostrils. Her mouth was a lipless crescent. She spoke to me, but I couldn't tell what she was saying. I think her vocal cords were as blurred out as her face. But the lipless crescent was unmistakably a smile. And there was a feeling, a vibe, if you like, that said I had absolutely nothing to fear from her.
Is he?
She touched the boot hanging on the line. Yes, very nice, I said. Do you understand me? She nodded and then made a gesture I knew well, a thumb and forefinger circle, which means okie-dokie pretty much the world over. Except, I guess, in certain rare cases where imbeciles flash it to mean white's rule. She did some more
is
and
has,
then pointed at my tennis shoes. What? She snatched the boot from the line, where it had been held by two wooden clothespins, the old-fashioned kind that don't have springs. Holding the boots in one hand, she pointed at my tennies with the other, then back to the boots. Asking if I wanted to trade, maybe? I'm tempted, but they don't look my size. She shrugged and hung both boots up. Other shoes and a single green satin slipper with a curled toe like a caliph would wear bobbed and turned in a hesitant breeze. Looking at that mostly erased face made me feel a little woozy. I kept trying to see her features as they had been. I almost could. She walked closer to me and sniffed at my shirt with her slit of a nose. Then she raised her hands to her shoulders and pawed at the air. I don't get it. She bounced on her feet and made a sound that, when added to the way she had sniffed me, clarified things. Do you mean radar? She nodded vigorously enough to make her thinning brown hair fly. She made a
woof, woof, woof
sound, which I guess was the closest she could come to woof, woof, woof. She's at my house. She nodded and put one hand on her chest above her heart. If you mean you love her, I do too, I said. When was the last time you saw her? The shoe woman looked at the sky, seemed to calculate, then shrugged.
Done.
If you mean long, it must have been because she's old now. Doesn't bounce too much these days. But Mr. Bowditch, did you know him? If you know Raids, you must have known Mr. Bowditch. She nodded with the same vigor, and the remains of her mouth turned up in another smile. She only had a few teeth, but the ones I could see were a startling white against her gray skin.
Adrian
Bowditch. She nodded hard enough to sprain her neck. But you don't know how long ago he was here? She looked at the sky, then shook her head. Was Radar young then?
Heavy.
Puppy. More nodding. She took my arm and pulled me around the corner. I had to duck under another line of dangling shoes to keep from being garroted. Over here was a patch of earth that had been turned and raked, as if she was getting ready to plant something. There was also a ramshackle little cart, leaning on a couple of long wooden handles. There were two burlap sacks inside, with green things sticking out of the tops. She knelt down and motioned for me to do the same. We faced each other that way. Her finger moved very slowly and hesitantly as she wrote in the dirt. She paused once or twice, remembering what came next, I think, then went on. SHGUDLIF. And then, after a longer pause, ? I puzzled over it and shook my head. The woman got on all fours and made her version of barking again. Then I got it.
Yes, I said. She's had a very good life. But now she's old, like I said, and she's not doing so well. It caught up with me then. Not just Radar and not just Mr. Bowditch, but everything. The gift that was a burden I was supposed to carry, the decomposing cockroaches, and finding the house at number 1 Sycamore torn apart, probably by the man who had murdered Mr. Heinrich, by the pure craziness of being here, kneeling in the dirt with a mostly unfaced woman who collected shoes and hung them on crisscrossing clotheslines. But above all, it was Raids, thinking of how she sometimes struggled to get up in the morning or after a nap, of how she sometimes didn't eat all her food and then gave me a look that said, "I know I should want it, but I don't." I began to cry. The shoe woman put her arm around my shoulders and hugged me to her.
"Oh, hey,"
she said.
Then, with an effort, she got it completely in the clear.
"Okay."
I hugged her back. She had a smell, faint but nice. It was, I realized, the smell of the poppies. I cried it out in big wet sobs, and she held me, patting my back. When I pulled away, she wasn't crying, maybe she couldn't, but the crescent of her mouth was turned down instead of up. I wiped my face with my sleeve and asked if Mr. Bowditch had taught her to write or if she already knew how. She put her gray thumb near her first two fingers, which were kind of stuck together. "He taught you a little?" She nodded, then wrote in the dirt again. FRENS. "He was my friend, too. He passed away." She cocked her head to one side, stringy clumps of hair falling to the shoulder of her dress. "Died." She covered her slit eyes, as pure an expression of grief as I've ever seen. Then she gave me another hug. She let go, pointed to the shoes on the nearest line, and shook her head. "No," I agreed. "He won't need shoes. Not anymore." She made a gesture toward her mouth and chewed, which was sort of awful. Then she pointed at the cottage. "If you're asking if I want to eat, thanks, but I can't. I need to get back. Maybe another time? Soon. I'll bring Radar, if I can." Before he died, Mr. Bowditch said there was a way to make her young again. I know that sounds nuts, but he said it worked for him. It's a big sundial. There. I pointed in the direction of the city. Her slit eyes actually widened a little, and her mouth opened in what was almost an O. She put her hands to her gray cheeks, looking like that famous picture of the woman screaming. She bent to the dirt again and swept away what she had written. This time, she wrote faster, and it might have been a word she'd used often because the spelling was right. DANGER. "I know. I'll be careful." She put her melted fingers to her half-erased mouth in a shh gesture. "Yes, I have to be quiet there. He told me that too. Ma'am, what is your name? Can you tell me your name?" She shook her head impatiently and pointed to her mouth. "Hard for you to speak clearly?" She nodded and wrote in the dirt. DEERIE. She looked at it, shook her head, brushed it away, tried again. DORA. I asked if Deary was a nickname. At least, I tried, but nickname wouldn't come out of my mouth. It wasn't as if I'd forgotten it, I just couldn't seem to say it. I gave up and asked, "Was Dearie Mr. Bowditch's friendly name for you, Dora?" She nodded and stood up, dusting her hands. I got up too. "It was very nice to meet you, Dora." I didn't know her well enough to call her Dearie, but I understood why Mr. Bowditch had. Her heart was kind. She nodded, patted my chest, then patted her own. I think to show that we were simpatico. Friends. The crescent of her mouth once more turned up, and she bounced on her red shoes, as I suppose radar might have bounced before her joints got so painful. "Yes, I'll bring her, if I can, if she's able. And I'll take her to the sundial, if I can." Although I had no idea how. She pointed at me, then gently patted her hands on the air, palms down. I'm not sure, but I think it meant, "Be careful." "I will. Thank you for your kindness, Dora." I turned toward the path, but she caught my shirt and tugged me toward the back door of her little domicile. "I really can't." She nodded to say she understood I couldn't stay for a meal, but kept tugging. At the back door, she pointed up. Something had been carved into the lintel, higher than Dora could reach. It was his initials. A.B. His original initials. I had an idea then, one that sprang from my inability to say the word nickname. I pointed to the initials and said, "That's awesome sauce," was in my mind, the stupidest slang term I could think of, but a good test case. I couldn't get it out of my mouth. It just wouldn't come. Dora was looking at me. "Amazing," I said. "That's amazing." 10. I climbed the hill, ducked through the dangling vines, and started back along the passageway. The sense of faintness, otherworldliness, came and went. The bats were rustling overhead, but I was too preoccupied with what had just happened to pay the sound much mind, and I stupidly turned on the flashlight to see how much farther I had to go. They didn't all fly, but a couple did, and I saw them in the beam of the light. They were big, all right, huge. I walked on, in darkness, one hand outstretched to fend them off if they flapped my way, but they didn't. If there were big roaches, I didn't hear them. I hadn't been able to say nickname. I hadn't been able to say awesome sauce. Would I be able to say Weisenheimer or knuckle sandwich or yo, you trippin', bruh? I didn't think so. I wasn't positive I knew what that inability meant, but I was pretty sure. I'd thought Dora understood me because she understood English, but what if she had understood me because I had been speaking her language? One where words like nickname and awesome sauce didn't exist? When the cobblestone stopped and the dirt began, I felt it was safe to turn the light back on, although I kept it trained at the floor. It was a quarter of a mile between where the cobbles ended and the steps began, Mr. Bowditch had said, even claimed to have measured it out. This time I didn't lose count of my paces, and I had just reached 550 when I saw the steps. Far above, at the top of the well, I could see light from the battery-powered units he'd installed. I climbed with more confidence than I'd felt when going down, but still kept my right shoulder firmly planted against the wall. I emerged with no incident, and was bending to slide the second board in place over the top of the well, when something circular and very hard pressed into the back of my head. I froze.
"That's right. Stay nice and still, and we'll have no problem. I'll tell you when to move."
It was very easy to imagine that light, sing-songy voice saying,
"What will you give me if I spin your straw into gold? I don't want to shoot you, kiddo, and I won't if I get what I came for."
And then he added, not as a laugh, but like words in a book,
"Ha-ha.